I know when we've done crazy sort of innovation sessions, we always come up with a color changing compost.
Yeah.
That is, gotcha. You know, that's what you need. So, you know, something that, you know, plays a tune when it needs to be fed. that sort of thing.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty.
We're currently putting together a two-part special episode going under the working title of Everything You Wanted to Know About Peat-Free Compost, But Were Afraid to Ask, where we'll be looking at the industry complexities and challenges in moving to peat-free. In our preparation for creating this programme, we caught up with Elaine Gotts, a senior R&D scientist based at the Levington Research Station, not far from Ipswich in the Suffolk countryside. Elaine has been working on developing peat alternative products for many years, and so we wanted to pick her brains and make use of her valuable insights. Our conversation is wide-ranging and so fascinating that we've decided to release it as an episode in its own right. Think of it as a primer for our peat-free special that'll be coming in a few weeks' time. We're delighted to welcome on The Underground today, Elaine Gotts, the R&D scientist from Evergreen Garden Care. Elaine, welcome to The Underground.
Morning, Elaine.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
So, Elaine, can you just give us a little bit of background to what you do at Evergreen?
So I have two hats at Levington. One is to manage the site, so the research station site, and the other is to look after all of our growing media formulations and development.
Right.
Just picking up on what you said that you're in charge of the site at Levington. Could you just explain a little bit about what that site is?
Yep. So Levington is owned by Evergreen Garden Care. It's a research station affiliated under ARITO. So we're ARITO certified, which means we're an officially recognised efficacy testing organisation. We're audited by the HSE under that scheme. And that means that the data that we generate is to the sufficient standard to be able to use it for pesticide registrations.
Okay.
Right.
So that's a big part of what we do, is supporting product registration in other categories beyond fertilisers and growing media. But because of that being a big part of what we do, we apply the same principles and rigour in terms of the way we set out our trials with replicates, and we score blindly and all of those kinds of things, and the way we do our statistics. We apply all of those standards across onto our growing media and fertiliser development as well.
So it's proper science, isn't it, that you do? It's not just a case of growing stuff. It's actually proper science that goes on.
Yep, we'd like to think so.
No, I mean, I've been there, you've been there, Phil, and we can both say it is an amazing, huge site with, quite good tech up there. It's a fascinating place to visit. It really is.
Is it as secretive and, you know, because you're in a research station, I always feel that it's this top seat as you enter the Levington. Yeah, exactly. So can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's relatively unsecret, if that's even a word, but it's not a super secretive operation. Certainly at Levington, we actually have a public road that goes through the centre of the site, so it's hard to do anything very secret. But having said that, none of our, you know, when we put our treatments out, nothing's labelled, so you'd be hard pressed to actually see what we're doing or make any sense of it.
Right.
But in terms of what we do, we have two large glass houses, one which is dedicated to fertilizer and growing media trials, and another one which is a specialist unit which is set up to do insecticide trials. For those, we artificially inoculate with mainly whitefly. So we do quite a lot of trials on whitefly. Okay. And also aphids sometimes. Outside, we grow crops which will naturally get pests and diseases. And for that, we have maybe three or four sets of rose bushes, and those are used on rotation for trials on rust and black spot, because Rose Clear is a big product for us. So fungus control on roses is still a big area in terms of plant protection product use. We have a large turf area, which is put down to different types of turf. So we have some areas where we encourage moss growth so that we can look at control of moss in turf.
Right.
And other areas that we sow with weed seeds. So a crazy part of our budget, which you wouldn't believe the cost of buying weed seeds. So as we've just renovated a large area, and as we sowed in the autumn, we put the grass seed down, and a couple of weeks later went over with a mix of common lawn weeds.
Wow.
So, and that's important because we can't just rely on a sort of natural infestation of weeds, because we need it to be a uniform spread across a big area so that we can do trials on them.
And I know it's not your area, Elaine, specifically your expertise, but that is another arena that is going more sustainable, more pesticide-free, isn't it? And I know Evergreen's quite definitely going towards that, as well as the peat-free journey.
Yeah, that's a big focus for our trials effort, is on moving towards more natural solutions across all of our product categories. So the trials that we do are across all of our categories apart from home pest, and home pest trials are done by our colleagues at Marance in our sister station in France.
Okay. Gosh.
Yeah, it's a lot going on, isn't there? And this may sound a bit like an obvious question, but can you just explain to me what the difference is between soil and compost?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think this is one of those situations where the English language has really confused us, and particularly confused consumers, because I guess you're asking me about growing media. You're not actually asking me the difference between compost and soil. You're asking me the difference between growing media and soil.
Right. So is there a difference between compost and growing media?
Yes. So
right.
compost is a verb and a noun. So to compost, you break down organic matter in the presence of air. So you compost in your compost heap in your garden.
Right.
And what you make through that process is compost.
Okay.
What we make and put into bags is growing media. But people buy it as compost.
Okay.
And the difference and the difference between compost or growing media and soil is, soil is sometimes described as soil in situ. So soil in your garden, in a field, where it's made in the ground, that's soil.
Okay.
So if you're planting in your beds and borders, you're planting into soil. Mm-hmm. If you're planting into a container, or maybe if you've built a raised bed and you've filled it with something else, then you're growing into growing media.
Got you.
Enlightening. So we've talked about the difference between compost, growing media and soil. So can you tell us a little bit about the growing media products that you helped to develop, Elaine?
Yes, so we are developing products just for Evergreen Garden Care, so anything that's under the Levington brand or the Miracle-Gro brand. And obviously a large part of what we've been doing over the past decades has been gradually moving away from a reliance on peat into being fully peat-free. And Miracle-Gro, as you know, is now 100% peat-free.
Right.
And we'll be moving to 100% peat-free on Levington very shortly. So testing hundreds of alternatives to peat over the past few decades.
Right. So you mentioned there about the industry moving to peat-free compost. Can you tell me what the challenges are in creating a compost product that is peat-free, and why it's so difficult?
I think one of the main challenges has been that, particularly from a consumer home gardener point of view, Our customers have got used to gardening in peat over a relatively short space of time, really, because the first peat-containing mixes weren't brought in until the late 60s.
Right.
But people have got used to working with that medium. And it's possible, it's absolutely possible to change, but people need to adapt the way that they grow as they adapt to new materials. I think from a technical point of view and from the trials that we do, we know that we can produce all kinds of really good peat-free mixes, but it's which of those mixes actually still perform in the hands of our consumers. And we can actually manufacture at scale. We can put them into a bag. They're going to be storage stable. They're going to give reliable results. There's 101 materials that you could use to replace peat, but there are only very few which meet that requirement to actually work in the hands of our consumers reliably.
Okay.
That's a really good answer. I like that, looking at the home gardener, and how that relates. You know, you're saying that there's really good quality peat-free compost out there. It's just relating it to the home gardener and how they use it and how you can store it. And that's kind of an answer we haven't really looked at before. So I'm going to ask a bit of an obvious, well, a bit might seem a silly question. So Evergreen Garden Care is a global company. And in Australia, I gather that they've never used peat. So if you have offices and a company in Australia, why can't we just recreate what they use in Australia?
It's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. And we've learned a lot from our colleagues in Australia in terms of how they produce their peat-free growing media and the materials that they use. But even between ourselves and our colleagues in France, there are geographical differences in the available substrates.
Right.
So you can imagine how many times that's multiplied if you think about going from here to Australia. So in terms of the materials they use, they have access to a lot of pine bark, which we don't have access to here. They're using biochar, which is produced from macadamia nuts.
Okay.
Not particularly available in the UK.
No, and that must be really expensive if it was here. Love macadamia nuts.
Macadamia nut shells, obviously no waste. And we see that in each of the geographies that we operate in,
right,
that it's a question of finding something that's available locally, because the economy around the production of growing media doesn't lend itself to shipping materials long distances. It's bulky material, and relatively low value versus the cost of transport. So we're all looking for local raw materials. Mm-hmm. But having said that, we're applying the same sort of principles in terms of what we're looking for and what we can use. So it's more on the sort of fertilizer side and additives that go with those substrates,
right,
that we can learn from Australia, New Zealand.
Okay. So what are the characteristics of growing media then that you're looking for?
So we're looking for three different categories of characteristics, if you like. So physical, chemical, and biological. So physically, we're looking for something which is easily flowable. It's relatively low density. It's, from a consumer point of view, a nice dark brown colour. That's really important to consumers.
Yes. Oh, really? Okay.
No, I get that. So, totally.
Yeah, you might find something that's bright pink, but it's not going to be acceptable in the pot. That's just how our consumers are. It's got to be nice and dark brown. So a uniform particle size distribution. So we grade most of our materials to 10 millimeter. So it's a fine, uniform physical material. Chemically, thinking about how we were with peat, we were used to working with a material which was acidic and had no nutrients in it. So it was a blank canvas. And from a fertilizer company point of view, we could put as much lime in as we wanted to adjust the pH to the right point. We could put in as much fertilizer as we wanted to get to the right fertilizer level for the plants you're growing. But with a peat-free, we're now working with the nutrient that comes in with the substrate as well. So most of the materials, from a chemical point of view, they're at least neutral pH. So we're not using as much lime anymore. And they bring some plant food with them as well. So we're looking at that. And within the chemical side of things, also making sure that we don't have excess heavy metals or anything like that, which you can get using materials from the circular economy. And then from a biological point of view, obviously has to be free from human pathogens, weed-free, and also stable. So materials that have been composted have actually finished their composting process and they're then stable to go on into a bag.
Goodness me. There's so much that goes into it. I mean, I do say to people, it's not just, you know, before digging up the peat bog, chucking it in a bag, peat-free is so much more complex. But goodness me, this really shows how interesting and how much research has gone into it.
Absolutely.
And that actually leads me onto my next question, that you said that you've been researching and developing peat-free compost for a few decades. Could you just tell us a little bit about the journey that you've been through? Because you've been with the company quite a while, haven't you, Elaine? So you've seen that journey from the beginning, is that right?
Yes. Yes, I have. So I joined what was Fison's at the time in 1989. And at that point, you know, Fison's was selling 100% peat-containing growing media. But that, even at that point, we were looking at non-peat ingredients.
Okay.
So the first trials that I came in to do, we were looking at replacing a portion of the peat with something else, whether that was bark, which is a fairly standard thing to do for nursery stock mixes at the time, or whether you could, you know, we had some batches of municipal waste even, you know, back at the end of the 1980s. So it's what we're doing now is really building on a very, very long program of research. But we produced the first professional peat-free compost under the Levington brand in 1992. So that was at the time, that was a pure bark mix. And it's gone on from there, really. There's always been, in parallel, a peat-free product for the consumer gardener as well, a multi-purpose product, and then a multi-purpose plus a grow bag, those being the two biggest volume lines. So having that option to offer to consumers. But then, you know, the rate of progress has really increased in recent years as we've moved into investment into wood fibre in particular, which has been a big investment for us.
Right.
But that was, you know, around 10 years ago now. So gradually increasing the proportions in mixes and over time reducing the proportion of peat. So as I said, you know, starting off from 100% peat, getting down to sort of 50-50 mixes, and then a very short step really from being predominantly peat-free in the mix. So once we'd got to 40% peat, it was quite a short step on to being totally peat-free.
Because I remember Jeff Hamilton, who was gardener as well at Barnsdale Gardens, just, you know, he was always peat-free, wasn't he? And that was that's quite a long time ago. So it's taken us a while to get there, but we're definitely seem to be there now.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds from what you're saying that it's an ongoing process and you're still developing new formulations. What are the key issues that you're trying to address or the benefits that you're trying to deliver?
I think in terms of the issues we're trying to address, it's really to make sure that we've got options available so that we can meet the volume demand that we have now. Because as the whole industry moves to peat-free, there's a lot of competition for each of those substrates. So some of the substrates that we've developed over the years are now moving up in price. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of looking at what we can do to maybe look at alternative sources, alternative ways of processing, and really maintaining. So we're benchmarking against our own peat-free standard, our, you know, where we know our product is, and making sure that we can make some tweaks to those formulations and maintain that level of performance, but using some different ingredients. So there are new things becoming available sort of over time. So things like digestate fibers weren't available in the way that they are now, sort of 5 years ago. Yeah. So as those materials become available at scale, then is there a role for those? If we put a small proportion of them into a mix, what do we take out? And it's all of those kinds of sort of tweaks and changes that we're looking at now to maintain. And also looking at, as we've now gone peat-free, where the next focus is going to be. And for us, we've been looking at how we can reduce the levels of coir that we've got in our mixes, for example, so that we can be ready for the next round, if you like, of environmental focus.
Right. You said that the cost of materials has gone up. Is that because everything's going up, or is it because there's so many more people trying to get that ingredient, that source? So is it kind of supply and demand?
Yeah, there's definitely this year we've seen a big shift in some materials on a supply and demand basis.
Right. Okay. That doesn't help the home gardener, does it, when that happens?
Well, no. And I think we need to bear in mind that, you know, in 2024, the professional industry isn't required to be 100% peat-free yet.
That's true.
But that will also come, and that will further increase the competition for materials.
You mentioned, Elaine, earlier that there are hundreds of different possible ingredients that you could choose for the formulations. How do you actually go about choosing those ingredients?
So we work together very closely with our supply chain colleagues. So a big part of the initial assessment of a material is to look at where it is, how practical it would be to supply it into our factories, what volume of it is available, and then from that, is it worth us investing in researching into it and making it possible to use?
Right.
Okay.
So if it's practical, or if it's something which is really new and has the potential to scale up, is that something that we want to invest in and invest in the development of as a substrate itself? So there's that sort of initial consideration of, is this something that could work commercially before we invest in looking at it? And then increasingly, because rather than just having peat, and saying, okay, can I put 10% of this into a peat base and does it have a positive or negative effect? We don't have that peat base to sort of work from anymore. Right. So it's more doing some physical and chemical analysis before we do any growing and comparing that with other materials that we're already using. So if, for example, the new material is very light, it's very low density, it has low nutrient content, it holds lots of air but not very much water, then shall we substitute that for some wood fibre?
Right.
If it's got lots of nutrients in it, it's very dense, can we substitute that for some green compost? It's looking at what it would replace in an existing mix and how, you know, whether that then has a positive, negative or neutral effect when it comes to growing plants.
Right.
Interesting. So you did mention coir earlier and about the possible environmental issues that are going to come up with that. So how important is sustainability when you're looking at new ingredients?
Well, that's one of the criteria that we're assessing against, because all of our formulations are assessed under the responsible sourcing scheme.
Right.
So that means any new ingredient that goes into those formulations has to be audited. So we need to be thinking about, you know, the energy used in producing it, which includes the distance it's been transported into the factories, how much water is used, how renewable is it, is there waste generated through its processing, is it produced responsibly from a corporate social responsibility point of view. All of those things go into the score. So we wouldn't want to add anything into the mix that then reduced the overall score for our product. So that's another consideration as well.
We're going to take a short break, but in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the Gardener Guru.
Well, actually, Phil, I want to talk about something different today, and I want to include you, because both of us were fortunate enough to go to the RHS Malvern show this week.
We were.
So I thought it'd be really good to have a little chat about our thoughts and, whatever you want to say about it, really.
Yeah, well, we had an absolutely lovely day out. We went on the Saturday. It was bakingly hot and very busy. But yeah, we had a great time. It was amazing to see all the different things. There's just a bit of an overload of plants and just trying to take everything in. But I picked out a couple of things which I really enjoyed.
Okay, do tell.
So the first thing, I am a sucker for indoor plants and houseplants, and they had a festival of houseplants. Which,
that's what I was going to talk about.
I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed looking around there. There's a couple of things which I spotted, which I thought were fantastic. They had houseplant installations, and one of them in particular was a tropical houseplant installation, which was created by a company called Grow Tropical. And I thought that was amazing. It just felt like you were inside a jungle. It was just brilliant. Yeah.
And I think the whole houseplant festival has really shown the power of Instagram, because so many of the guys exhibiting came about through Instagram, and often during lockdown. So you had the bearded plantaholic, you got Joe Bagley, the UK houseplant, Sarah Gerard Jones, the plant rescuer, so many people, and Ben Newell, all helping each other. And they've all become this incredible community, and Ellen Mary Webster as well. So it's incredible to see how houseplants has really brought, and I hate to say it, younger people together, because they genuinely are younger. So to see the power of Instagram, actually a force for good, you know, because that houseplant festival would not have come about without Instagram and the content creators that are there with the houseplants.
Yeah, and what a great opportunity that is for garden centres to increase their houseplant offering. I think that's, you know, something which
absolutely
Boyd was talking about the other day when we spoke to him, was saying houseplants are a really big thing that garden centres should be embracing more.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think they are, although there is still some way to go, definitely. What else? Houseplants, what else? Floated your boat?
So this was my first time to the Malvern show. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And the show gardens were much smaller than I thought they were going to be. So I thought that was quite interesting. I went around those quite quickly, but what I really enjoyed was the school gardens.
Oh, they were great, weren't they?
Really good fun. Yeah. And I think those school gardens, you know, if you were a kid and you were at school and you were taking part in building one of those gardens, I think you would really thoroughly enjoyed it. They were fun. They had so much life going on. Really creative. There was a musical theme.
I know, I love that. Gardens. I thought that was a great idea. Yeah, really, really good. And actually, Lee Connolly posted about he's going to Chelsea for the press day. I think it's his first time. And he was he has been slightly critical of the RHS not pushing school gardening and children's gardening enough. So I did kind of reply about that and how at Malvern they had the school gardening. It was good to see. But having said that, the RHS have done a lot for school gardening. It's just kind of behind the scenes. It's kept quiet. So I think they do need to shout out a bit more about what they do. But going back to what you were saying about the show gardens, they are small because a lot of designers cut their teeth at Malvern.
Right, okay.
So if you're a fairly new garden designer, or you're not that well known and you want to create a show garden, the RHS will sometimes encourage you to start at somewhere like Malvern or Tatton Park, the smaller shows, just to cut your teeth, as I said, and see how you go. And then if they do really well, then they often will be invited to maybe Hampton Court next step, and then Chelsea.
Got
so that is often, it's a good career progression. So that's why they're a bit smaller, because you haven't got to find the money that some of these big show gardens cost at Chelsea.
No, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. But generally, we had a great day out. the head gardener at Wright Towers came away with a good collection of plants. So, yes, a good time had by all.
Oh, good.
So was there anything else that you spotted that you...
I just love the Flora Marquee. And for me, my favourite exhibit in there was just right at the entrance, actually, and it was the Saracenas,
okay,
the pitcher plants, and ones that you can grow outdoors here in the UK. And they just look majestic. And I absolutely love them. But also there was an incredible tulip display, all in pots. Mm. And I, you know, with the hot weather, I was amazed how well they lasted. And just the colours and the different variety of tulips was just mind blowing.
Absolutely.
So yeah, just being in that Flora Marquee, although it did get a bit hot, it was massive. And there was just so much you could see and buy and get advice. And that's one of the wonderful things about these Flora Marquees at the shows, is that you get advice straight from the horse's mouth from the growers.
Absolutely.
And they really know their plants and they are happy to talk to you as well. So if you do go to a show and you want to know about a plant, go and talk to the nursery growers, because they will happily answer your questions.
Brilliant. Well, I'm glad you had a lovely time.
Absolutely. And maybe a few cocktails or drunk as well.
Got to be done. And back to the show.
So what would be your kind of magic ingredient? What would be the properties that you're looking for if you could just find one ingredient?
I'm not sure there is such a thing. and I think there's definitely a benefit in the mixes that we have now being a combination of different materials,
right,
versus reliance on a single material, which is where we were, you know, where we've come from with peat.
Yeah.
But in terms of the ideal characteristics, I think something which is easy to manage, so something which is easy to water.
Right.
I mean, if you're talking magical ingredients, something that indicates to you when you need to water, right, would be ideal. Yeah. That was, you know, I know when we've done crazy sort of innovation sessions, we always come up with a color-changing compost.
Yeah.
That is, gotcha, you know, that's what you need. That, you know, something that, you know, plays a tune when it needs to be fed. That sort of that sort of thing.
That would be great.
But you know, anything that's easy to manage, nice to handle, holds onto nutrients well. So something which, not to be too technical, but something which has good cation exchange capacity. So it holds onto the nutrients. It will buffer them, so you can put lots of fertilizer in. It's not going to burn the plant, but it'll be there to release slowly and nurture it over time. So it makes a product foolproof for the consumer. And that's, you know, that's what it's all about, really, is making something which in the hands of the consumer will get their plants to thrive and will make them feel successful. Because that's what we need our customers to have a good result from our products and enjoy the whole gardening process.
So Elaine, you've talked about making everything easier for the, you know, for your consumer, for the home gardener. What do you think are some of the challenges that are facing home gardeners with growing in peat-free? Are there challenges?
Yeah.
Is it just our mindset, the way we have to use our garden?
I think it's an adaptation.
Right.
It's not inherently difficult to grow in peat-free. And I think for new consumers coming in who have never experienced growing in peat, then they will come into a peat-free world and they will be able to garden successfully. But we've just got a little bit of transition to do over the next few years to adapt the way we're used to growing. And, you know, as I mentioned before, it's a relatively short period of time in terms of gardening history that we've been growing in peat-based compost.
Absolutely.
So it's been done before, so it can surely be done again, because people have moved on from growing mainly in John Innes type mixes, soil-based mixes, to growing in peat. And okay, there wasn't the social media sort of going on at the time, sort of the 50, 60 years ago, but people adapted to a different way of growing, and that's what we need to do again, to just adapt to a different way of growing. And like I was saying, when you asked about the ideal mix and being something that's very, very easy to use, I think we just need to adapt our watering particularly, and our fertilising as well, because we've got very used, I think, to having a product that you can just throw into a pot, you throw in your plant, you water it, and maybe look at it again next weekend and, you know, are amazed by how it's flourished. Whereas with a peat-free product, I think gardeners need to just be a little bit more involved in the process.
Which is a good thing.
I don't think it's a bad thing. But you do need to be more involved with your plants, check on them, and then look. And, as you know, from the messaging that we've got on our bags of compost, not just looking at the surface of the pot, but seeing whether it's wet underneath. Because I think overwatering is probably a bigger issue than underwatering.
Definitely.
With peat-free, because people are looking at it and thinking, oh, it's dry on the surface, I'd best water it. And actually, you know, sometimes you're given a plant from someone who's like, I don't know what I've done wrong. I can't think what I've done. And you pick it out and the roots are all in the top half of the pot and the bottom half is just sodden and there's nothing growing there. So it's an adaptation, I think, and we'll get over it. It's just a new way.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I've been growing successfully peat-free for quite a few years now. But I will just ask you one question. And it does come up a lot on social media. And I myself have had an issue. I know, Phil, we were talking earlier, just you're going to hate me, Elaine. I'm going to say the dreaded words of fungus gnats.
Yeah.
Do you think, that we're seeing an increase because of peat-free, or is it an increase because more people are gardening, are using houseplants? Have you got any tips on dealing with them? Is it something that's going to go away, or is it something, again, we've got to adapt to?
I think it's another one of those we're going to have to adapt to it.
Right.
Situations. And, you mentioned the fact that we have a business in Australia.
Yeah.
Where they've been 100% peat-free. And actually, the only peat-containing product they sell is a fungus gnat-free product for houseplants.
Oh, really?
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Really interesting that they've identified that this is an issue. It's not an issue outside in the garden. But for people with a lot of houseplants particularly, I'm in my kitchen and I've got lots of houseplants around, but I don't water them very often, so they stay quite dry.
Yeah.
If you grow them wet, then yes, you do start to get some flies off of them, and they are a nuisance. So it's really a question of, I think, growing a little bit drier.
Okay.
Because the fungus gnats, as the name suggests, they're not growing on the plant. They're not damaging the plant.
Yeah.
They're growing on the fungi, which are breaking down the components in the growing media.
Right.
Ah, okay. Hence the name.
Yeah, hence the name. So if you've got mold in your compost, then that's what's attracting the fungus gnats. So whatever you do to control that mold, so if you grow a bit drier, then you'll get rid of the fungus gnats as well. So once you see the live adults flying around, you can get some quite almost decorative yellow sticky traps to put in the tops of your pots, the different shapes and things, and that will capture them. If they're a real issue, if you've got a load coming off of a newly potted plant, and it's all about breaking the life cycle, so they're not going to then be laying their eggs into the compost. And it's the larvae stage in the life cycle that's then eating the fungus, and then they go into their winged stage and you see them flying around. So it's a question of breaking that life cycle and getting to grips with them that way.
But I think one thing we ought to stress is that as annoying as they are, they're very rarely going to do any damage. Maybe to seedlings, they could nibble on the roots of seedlings. But if you've got, established houseplants and established other plants, that they're not going to do any damage.
No.
It's just the annoyance. Okay, thank you.
What is it that you enjoy most about working within the garden sector?
I think it's just infinitely variable. There's just so much going on all the time. I guess it's something I'd always wanted to do. So it's not something that I've sort of thought, oh, I'll have a go at that and maybe I'll get bored and do something else. It's something I've always wanted to do, but thinking about the home garden side of things versus professional horticulture, I think it's the involvement with I know growers are real people as well, but real consumers. And when you get to talk to consumers and they say, oh, I used your product and it was fantastic. And they, you know, they say, look at this, and this is so much better because you gave me this bottle of plant food and I've never fed my plants before, you know, for example. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a revelation to people. And you think, actually, I've helped to develop a product that's actually improved someone's experience of their green space. And it's actually made a difference. That's really good.
Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. I love
fantastic.
That.
Fantastic. So you are obviously a very busy woman. Do you enjoy gardening yourself, Elaine?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Have you always enjoyed it?
I have. Yeah. I mean, when I was at school, when you got to do the whole sort of what you want to do when you leave school, careers thing, I wanted to do horticultural research. So that was what I wanted to do. And that was from, I guess, being in the garden with my dad and my granddad forever. So it's just sort of
that's lovely.
Something that I've always wanted to do. Being in the garden is, it's great. It's important to me.
Oh, lovely. That's interesting because you said that, you know, you always wanted to do horticulture research. We've been talking to a few young people and the Young People in Horticulture Association as well. And one of the things they're saying is that it was never encouraged at school. And most people wouldn't have even known that being a horticulture researcher was something out there. Were you given any kind of help from school, or was this just something love being in the garden, what can I do?
Absolutely not. When I said I wanted to do horticultural, I wanted to do horticultural research, I was, you're quite good at maths, why don't you be an accountant?
Oh, goodness. Okay, right.
I'd like to do something so I can be outside. No, there's no money in that. You shouldn't do that. No, it would be much better.
Really?
You know, you could do computer science, or you could do maths and be an accountant.
That was it.
So I definitely wasn't encouraged at school.
So it's very much you had to find out what you could do. And okay, interesting.
Yeah. But having said that, when it came to doing work experience, I was found a job on a nursery. I started working on Saturdays in a nursery with a garden centre attached to it, and worked there because I didn't do a horticulture degree, again because I was advised against it. But if I had of really done what I wanted to do and done a horticulture degree, at that point you needed to have a year's worth of experience before you started on a degree. Okay. So all my Saturdays were sort of building up hours to say I'd got the experience. But in the event, I did an applied biology degree because it had wider application rather than looking for the elusive job in horticultural research, which was what I really wanted. But I got there in the
end. Absolutely. And it really has been a lifelong passion of yours.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And Elaine, finally, do you have a plant or flower that will always put a smile on your face, however kind of low you might be feeling?
So I can't think of a single answer, but I think it's really the association of plants with people.
Lovely.
Is what puts a smile on my face. So whether it's a plant that I've inherited, or a plant that I've grown with someone else, that's what puts a smile on my face.
So it's a specific plant rather than a type of plant?
No, it could be both. So, for example, I always grew strawberries with my granddad. And whenever I managed to pick my strawberries, because he grew strawberries commercially, and when I managed to pick my strawberries, when Wimbledon's on, I think, yes. because he said, you know, you've got to get them ready for Wimbledon because that's when you get the best price.
Yeah, of course.
Back in the day. Love it. So that always reminds me of him. So that puts a smile on my face. And then there are other plants that, yeah, are now very old and you kind of feel a bit of a pressure to make sure that they don't die on your watch. But yeah, then they remind me of people as well.
Oh, so, that's lovely. Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, I just want to say thanks so much, Elaine, for your time today. It's been thoroughly entertaining and interesting. You've given us a real insight into what you do at Livington Research Station and also what goes into a bag of compost. Who knew?
Thanks, Elaine.
Thank you.
Well, goodness me, Phil, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Finding out all about the kind of research that's gone into producing a bag of peat-free.
You just take it all for granted that what's in the bag of compost or growing media, as we've been told we should call it, is just works. And there's just so much that goes into it now that never used to have to. It's so much more complex.
And I think they're very much this kind of trying to get rid of this negativity that we're finding is around peat-free. We didn't talk about potential inferior products. And I think, you know, that was, again, to Elaine's credit that she, you know, didn't say there's lots of rubbish out there. I mean, we might say that, but it was great. You know, let's get away from this negativity and just adapting. I like that word. You know, it's not got to be different. You've just got to adapt, and it's not a hard adaptation.
No, absolutely. And being able to spend more time with your plants. Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
It's not a bad thing, is it? And I don't think we kind of delved into half of it, really.
Not at all. I mean, she absolutely knows her stuff.
She really does. And also knowing that that Evergreen is a global company is quite interesting, that, you know, they're in Australia, they're in Northern Europe. A lot of people, you know, wouldn't have known that. So, yeah, just it's not just us that are having these issues.
Yeah, fascinating.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Kate.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at wrightobarra.com. Thanks for listening.